The Humanitarian Studies Initiative has been a program that's been running for 3 years at McGill, and it came from its sister program at Harvard University. And the focus of these programs are to train humanitarian professionals in disaster and humanitarian emergency response. Over the years, from previous disasters and emergencies, we've really seen that there's a need for standardized training so that we're sending the best people into the field that we can. So the training program that I run at McGill is comprised of a classroom portion and then a field-based simulation training portion. And then all of those students also do a field placement with an international organization like Médecins Sans Frontières.
Classically, organic chemistry has always been done in the last 200 years in organic solvent. So we're one of the leading groups in the world and develop new ways to make organic compounds in water. And it really is completely contradictory to any of the things we have learned before. Green chemistry concept is totally new thinking where, in fact, you want the best solvent is you want the whatever you want to accomplish, but you don't want to dissolve. So if any of the organic molecules are not soluble in water, but you still can have the reaction to occur just by floating the organic molecule on water. And as long as the reaction can occur, you don't have to worry about whether it's soluble or not. So it's a totally new concept.
I'll give you the answer that I get asked by customs officials every time I travel through airports, and they ask, what do you do? And I take a deep breath, and I think, should I just say I'm a law professor? And that sometimes scares them, and I get through really fast. Or I actually say what I really do, which is look at the interaction between biotechnology and society, and what some people might think are science fiction issues, others take very seriously as necessary for human survival or progress or for the fight against disease and so on. So I try to give a short answer, and normally the fastest way is to say, have you heard about Dolly? And then everyone says, oh, the sheep, oh. And then they start about cloning, or they start talking about, yes, what about genetics? That's bad, isn't it? There's all these genes and you're manipulating them, aren't you, in the laboratories. And so sometimes it takes a while to get through customs.
I'm interested in understanding how to build a brain. And so fortunately, all the instructions to building a brain are written molecularly in the genome. And so my research focuses on deciphering those instructions and uncovering the molecules and strategies that the neurons in a brain used to connect with each other to form functioning neural circuits. And so this research will help us understand how a brain can essentially just self-assemble or wire up and function as soon as an animal is born, with innate or hardwired behaviors like breathing. And then this will also aid in understanding how these wiring instructions can go awry during abnormal brain development.
I study Chinese women's writings from the 17th to 19th centuries. This period is known as Late Imperial China, and it consists of the last two dynasties in China, the Ming and Qing dynasties. I've digitized more than 90 collections of these women's writings and have put them on the web, which is located on McGill's library website. And this is freely available to researchers all over the world. From their writings, we now discover that Chinese women were active historical actors and agents, both at home and also in society, perhaps in more indirect ways than we now know. We really get a very different picture of Chinese women, as well as actually the society that they lived in.
I am a Cold War historian. I'm interested in particular the socialist world in the Cold War, and my first book was about China and the Soviet Union, but I'm more interested now in how during the Cold War the structures of the post-Cold War world emerged. Well, conventional historians argue that the fall of the Berlin Wall to a certain degree marks the end of the Cold War, and of course it is a very decisive event in the Cold War in Europe, but that date, November 9th, 1989, is meaningless for the other regions in the world, like East Asia or the Middle East. So my question is, when does the post-Cold War world in each of these world regions actually start? And one can trace these developments, and if you look at East Asia or the Middle East, you certainly could make the argument that the post-Cold War structures emerge starting in the early 1980s.
My specialty is in the theory of musical form, which has to do with how musical pieces are constructed, how they're divided into sections, how they structure themselves at all sorts of different levels in musical works. This is the very beginning of a movement, and this is the opening idea. This is the initial statement, and then it's followed by a kind of response. And this brings a small kind of cadence right here. There's a sense of an end. In fact, my Killam project is precisely on how compositions achieve closure at different levels in the musical structure. And so my study of cadence is a study of some of these techniques that are very specifically directed towards projecting the sense, now we're coming to the sense of an end.
Mathematical physics in general means using modern mathematical techniques to actually learn something about physics, something about nature. We have a very good theory describing physics on everyday energy scales, I mean solids, fluids, gases. But even though we have the equation, we don't actually know what it tells us because we can't solve it. And this has to do with the fact that there are a large number of particles involved, usually. So the gas in this room would contain, well, I shouldn't make an estimate when I'm live on camera, but it's probably 10 to the 23 particles or something like that. So it's unbelievably big. I mean, a one with 23 zeros. So, and the equation is just one equation describing all these particles. So it's clear there's no way we can hope to actually solve this equation. But nevertheless, we would like to learn something about what the equation predicts, because it tells us something about how nature works.
The mind process then will tell you, you need to find out in what sequence you are going to extract materials from the ground. So this is, let's say, year one, two, three.
Yes.
The question is, how can you use the uncertainties, be that market, we call that demand, or the ore body, we call that supply. How these two can be managed in a way that they maximize whatever our objectives are. If you look into the modeling of the uncertainty of the supply, well, this is an area that we developed the last, particularly the last 3-4 years, a new generation of modeling. We call it high-order models, and it's quite new. I don't think it exists anywhere else. Why do we do it? We do it because our ability to forecast what might be possible content of metal in a block, and therefore value, can be better assessed.
Well, Andermann syndrome is a genetically determined disorder of the nervous system, which is inherited as an autosomal recessive, that is the result of a marriage of carriers, of two carriers. The children who were affected with this came from the Charlevoix region of Quebec. So it was pulling all this together, the genetics and the neurological involvement and the pathological findings and the electroencephalographic findings and the geographic distribution of the occurrence of this. It is something that does not respond to any particular treatment. But there's been enormous progress in its recognition and, in particular, in its prevention. Seeing this and trying to reduce this by your treatment of people is, I think, a worthwhile way of spending your life.
I have been directing the Division of Cancer Epidemiology for the past 16 years or so. We are a group of researchers, students, staff, and our focus is on studies of cancer epidemiology and causes of cancer, the means to preventing cancer. We have had great opportunities for great discoveries, and these discoveries have fed into not only our own research, but also have led to interventions that have, as I said, have also helped women's health, not only in terms of vaccination, prevention, but also screening, early detection of disease. We have had other fronts also that we have tackled, other diseases, cancer of the pharynx, also cancers in children, which is also a very important area of concern for our group.
Over my career, I've worked on all kinds of topics and periods to do with Canada, French Canada, natives and missionaries and so on. But at the moment, and for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been working on a topic that covers all of North America in the colonial period, and it's about land. It's basically how land becomes property in the process of colonization. So it's both how settlers set up new ways of owning land, and natives are dispossessed. And normally those are seen as two separate processes, but I see them as two sides of the same coin.
I studied Jews in Eastern Europe, which means for my purposes, because of my period, Jews in Poland and Lithuania, between about 1500 and 1800. My argument is this, that in these conditions, where Jews for a couple of centuries had a relatively secure situation and lived the dailiness of their lives in a Jewish context and created a culture largely from the palette of their own traditions, this created a kind of core positive view of themselves as Jews. So the Jew who becomes a communist or who becomes a Zionist or who assimilates almost entirely, nevertheless, most of the time will retain this kind of positive self-evaluation, but a sense of themselves as Jews, even if they've left religious belief behind.
I'm a perinatal epidemiologist. That means that I study population health of mothers, pregnant women, mothers, babies. In the early 70s in North America, and I think this is true of Western Europe, breastfeeding had hit its really low point. It was low after the war and continued to go down, and there was this kind of notion that science can do better than evolution, or that Mother Nature, if you want to put it that way. I found this intriguing, and so I thought it represented both an important new area at that time to study, and it intrigued me because of this contrast between so-called science, that we could scientifically do better than evolution has done over a couple, you know, over 100 million years or so. I'd like to think that research has had a beneficial effect on health.
Mostly, I think what my work has been doing is providing facts for public debate. I've been looking at, you know, how couples share, you know, housework, domestic work, time with their children, their money. Then after that, you know, cohabitation become more and more important, and divorce and separation kept increasing. So I looked for a while at what was the consequences of separation, mostly from the father's point of view. Would they keep contact with their children, and how would it change? And then after that, I study step families, because, you know, the earlier they separate, you know, the more chances they have to form another family. Some of those results influence a bit the development of policies, you know, at the federal level, like the Justice Department, when they're talking about custody and child support.
Our focus is actually to essentially identify the molecular events involved in breast cancer progression. And so we use a number of genetic tools to basically elucidate those events. And basically we use mouse models of human breast cancer, where we actually introduce genes or we delete genes to determine their relative contribution to breast cancer phenotypes. We also look at genes that whose loss of function in the mammary epithelium might contribute to cancer progression. These are so-called tumor suppressors. So we're looking at both axes of growth control in these animal models.
The focus of my research is the functions of the prefrontal cortex, a very complex part of the brain that is critical in our abilities to plan and organize our life. One of the things that we have identified is a specific region of the prefrontal cortex, the mid-dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, that is critical for the tracking of information that is in what we call our working memory, our current awareness, if you like. One way of thinking about it is that it is a part of the brain that controls, that keeps track of our intentions, what we intend to carry out during the day or in the next short while. And then as we perform those tasks, there seems to be a mechanism in the brain that keeps track of which ones of those things have been performed and which things remain to be performed. So you can imagine that this is critical for a properly organized daily life.
My field focuses on the processes that concentrate metals in the Earth's crust, metals that will in some cases be concentrated to levels sufficient to actually mine them, so economic resources of metals. The conventional wisdom says the only way you can transport metals is in hot water. We're now looking at the possibility that you could transport metals in vapors. And we're doing this by looking at active volcanoes. For example, the volcano that we're looking at in Indonesia has very high concentrations of copper coming out of it. So the question is why? Turns out that this volcano is pumping out tons, hundreds of tons per day of sulfur. And sulfur binds with the metal to allow it to transport in the vapor phase.
Clark Fraser made three enduring original contributions quite some time ago. The first one was, while he was a medical student, he perceived that medical genetics was a discipline, as it were, and he created a medical genetics clinic in the Montreal Children's Hospital. It was the first such clinic in that type of location in Canada. The second thing that he did was to study the process by which a congenital malformation might occur. He used a cleft lip, cleft palate model in the mouse and showed that not only the genetic background but the environmental experience contributed to that lesion, and the timing of the process could be as much as half a day in the developing mouse. The third thing he did was to give us a definition of genetic counseling. When parents are faced with a child affected with a genetic problem or malformation, they want to know why and what to do about it. His definition covered those issues, and we now have a profession called genetic counseling.
Peter Macklem was an extraordinary and brilliant scientist who did pioneering work in the application of physiology to pulmonary medicine. He helped develop the concept of the importance of the small airways of the lung, and he was crucial in bringing forward the importance of the diaphragm and understanding how, its physiology, something which is applied every day in intensive care units and wherever mechanical ventilation is used. He was also a wonderful organizer and leader of Canadian respiratory research and brought together all of the leading members of the Canadian respiratory community through the Respiratory Health Networks of Centers of Excellence grant, which established collaborations that continue even to this day.
I like to find with colleagues a good unanswered question. It must be a good, it must be important, and it must have relevance. I then like to go to work to design a study to address the problem, to get the data, to have your statistician help you, to finish up with a publication which answers some small question which you think is important. It's very hard work, but the rewards are there. That's what I'd tell a young person. Find your good question, and there are plenty around, and McGill is a very fertile place to find these good questions.
Les nouvelles morbidités sont beaucoup d'ordre, en fait, qui touchent le développement de l'enfant et souvent associées à des causes sociales. Et en pédiatrie, on n'était pas vraiment équipé pour faire face à ce type de morbidité qui nuit énormément aux enfants, tant dans leur cheminement de vie, de leur réussite scolaire, de leur qualité de vie aussi. Et je voulais une approche qui soit très, très près des gens, où on mobilise davantage les communautés puis les familles. Maintenant, on est rendu une dizaine de centres de pédiatrie sociale en communauté au Québec, où les universités participent avec des stages de résidents en pédiatrie et en médecine familiale. Et c'est devenu un concept, une approche qui est une approche très globale, très proximale et très intensive aussi par rapport au suivi d'une trajectoire d'enfant.
So we're trying to understand how broader social influences can actually affect the brain and its function over long periods of time. We look at variations in parenting, mother interactions with her rat pups, and find that the way the mother interacts with her pups actually comes to influence directly the environment in which DNA or genes operate within the brain, and in particular genes that influence stress responses of the animal over the lifespan. So we think we may have contributed to an understanding of how variations in parenting, for example, can stably alter those traits that then come to influence how we respond to stress. And because our responses to stress are so influential with respect to our health, thus differences in vulnerability to particular diseases.